Three, two, one. After announcing the decision to open the Park Road to people doing business in Kantishna, it's been one question after another for Park Superintendent Russell Berry. Berry says he had no choice in the matter. One private landowner asked that people be allowed to drive through the campground he's opening out there. Berry says that's his right under the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, and if they open the road for one, in fairness, they must open it for all. Questions raised in Fairbanks about the decision centered on whether the road would be improved and made safer, and if any limits would be placed on road access. Berry says access is up to the landowners in Kantishna. Steps are being taken to ensure that travel back there is authorized now, but the businesses will control that, and scenarios were painted showing how loose those authorizations could be. Berry says traffic is increasing now, but not to unsafe levels, but he's not sure what to expect this weekend. When asked how bad it could be, he says it could look like the September weekend when the road is traditionally open to the public.
It's an unusual new situation, and you really don't know what's going to happen. It's hard to forecast. That's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is people exercise restraint. We don't get a heavy buildup. People that do drive the road exercise the rules of the road carefully, and we're able to accommodate the park visitors and buses and increase traffic to Kantishna at the same time.
Those at the meeting critical of the new access say wildlife will move farther away from the traffic, so viewing opportunities will be affected. One woman compared it to Yellowstone Park, saying you see lots of cars, but not many animals. Berry says under Anilka, he had no choice but to open the road. But Mike Welsh says under Anilka, Berry also can approve reasonable regulations to that access, similar to what's been done with miners. Welsh believes the decision to open the road was made to provoke a crisis.
The law does say that access is guaranteed, but the law also says that it's subject to reasonable regulation, and there are a number of things that he could do to minimize the conflicts between the user groups, which is going to be inevitable if this thing proceeds the way it's developing now. You know, people are going to be annoyed that they can't get on a bus and go back there, and not everyone is going to be able to get a voucher from Mr. Ashbrook or whoever. And ultimately, I see a lot of people being turned away from the park.
Another frequent visitor to the park, Willie Caritas, says the decision implies the needs of the few outweigh the needs of the many.
Out in Kantishna now, they're able to do anything, and they can build a 500-room Hyatt. They can run coupons in the News Miner, come get a free hot dog, and they can get access to go into the park. The bottom line safety or access issue is really, as far as the national interest, really not being served because they aren't able to access everyone. You're just accessing the few people who can go out to Kantishna rather than the multitude of people who are served by the tour buses and the shuttle buses. And it seems ludicrous. It seems like a big power play for the Park Service to acquire the in-holdings in Kantishna. And at the same time that happens, I think that they're going to push for paving the road the whole way without respect to the wildlife concerns out there. And I think that the values of the Park Service are at question.
Safety concerns were also raised about the narrow, curving road that leads to Kantishna. Berry has already said that tour buses will be stopped 30 miles into the park if traffic becomes unsafe. Berry got some suggestions on ways to make the road safer, and he says they may be helpful. He says they are already giving information out when people enter on the hazards of driving the road, but there's no restriction on where you can drive once you're in. As far as controlling traffic on the road, he says it's possible in the short term with concurrence of the landowners, but not in the long run, because rapid growth in the area will ultimately force the issue of unlimited access taking precedence over park visitors' access.
The irreconcilable conflict between the use of the road as a park road for park visitors and buses and the use of the road as an access road to Kantishna for private ownership of commercial businesses is irreconcilable. And without a legislative change, the system cannot work. And if the system cannot work, the access holders take precedence and the buses will eventually need to be withdrawn.
Barry says there are four alternatives to the current situation. One of them includes changing ANILCA, and another would involve the federal government buying out the Kantishna landowners. Barry says any solution requires legislative action. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service spokesman Bruce Batten says it's a problem they were afraid would come up, and says it may be one of the worst examples of a snafu.
Hearings are scheduled and taking place in different parts of the state, and it's an interagency task force working on this plan for the subsistence. So we divided up the meetings, and the one in Juneau, for instance, was conducted by the Forest Service, the ones in Anchorage and Bethel by the Fish and Wildlife Service. The one in Fairbanks was to be conducted by the National Park Service, and they apparently had some confusion as to who was going to provide what, and the long and the short of it was that we had intended that materials be presented, including a copy of the plan, and someone be there to answer questions about the plan, but they didn't show up, and so it's one of those goofs that we regret, and mistakes happen, I guess.
Batten says fortunately a judge was present and the meeting could officially go on, which was the goal. National Park Service spokesman Bill Welch agrees that despite the confusion, getting those comments was the main objective.
There were just a lot of agencies involved, and that was the reason that there was a mix-up there, I think. The basic intent of any of these meetings was to get the public testimony, so certainly that occurred in Fairbanks. And I guess nothing was really, as long as people were giving their testimony, the purpose for the meeting was accomplished. It's unfortunate that there was not a federal person there to be able to answer questions or respond to the audience.
Fish and Wildlife spokesman Batten says 21 people testified at the hearings, and everyone who wanted to comment had the opportunity to. So another hearing probably won't be scheduled because of the timeline.
This whole public comment process has been a tremendous frustration for us as an agency because it hasn't been as long as we'd like to have it. We don't really have time to schedule any more hearings or even more, as many as we wanted to have out in the bush, for instance. We've got to close the comment period by June 18th so that we can get the plan in effect by July 1st. So we don't really have the option open to have another hearing. I do want to point out, though, that this is for an interim temporary regulation, and if we have to go into a permanent regulation program, there will be ample opportunity for people to be involved in the process, and that will include plenty of advance notice for hearings and hearings in lots of different areas. So we understand this is a compressed public comment process, and that there's going to be problems with it. We know that. It's the best we can do with the time crunch we've got to work under.
Written comments on the proposed regulations can be turned in through today. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Most of the state is showing an increased unemployment rate over last year. A lot of that is because of the oil spill workers that were included in last May's workforce that aren't in this May's workforce.
The hearings seem to have been hastily and shoddily put together. I know that there was a hearing officer that came to Fairbanks, and there was not even a representative of the Fish and Wildlife Service. There was an Eskimo woman who was told by the hearing officer to stop speaking a foreign language. He did, in fact, apologize for that. But the public process is very shoddy.
Will we find a solution? I'm not certain.
Indeed, says Bill Hudson, nobody can predict what will happen next week, but the Juneau Republican says it appears certain there are not enough votes to place a constitutional amendment on subsistence before the voters. Still, Hudson says he's glad there's a special session starting on subsistence. He thinks not enough information was available to legislators in May, and a session lasting perhaps a week will help focus the issues. Hudson sits on the Natural Resources Committee in the House, which will have a hand in crafting legislation And he says,
my vote when we come up and my position on this whole subject will be to try to expand the discussion beyond just fixing it through the Constitution, to look at the question of challenging the courts.
That means, he says, joining litigation expected to be filed by Anchorage area sports hunters against the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Act. Not, says Hudson, to overturn rural subsistence preference entirely, but rather to return fish and game management to state hands, and then perhaps using a system of statutory and regulatory changes to ensure subsistence needs are fulfilled.
I heard almost 5.5 hours at the Egan Center in Anchorage of one native elder after another that really stirred me, indicating that their physiological and psychological needs were for the native wild foods, that they were being pushed more and more onto the domestic white man's food, and it was affecting their health. I think there's a recent study that came out and suggested that. And I think these things have to be taken into consideration. I find no intolerance for that position.
As an interim step while litigation is underway, Hudson told the Juneau Chamber of Commerce on Friday that perhaps the state constitution could be amended to a time certain, allowing a subsistence preference, and that a special commission be established.
That would perhaps look over this whole subject and hopefully bridge the polarization that has taken place here and bring this whole subject back into a single issue concern.
That, says Hudson, is one of the problems Alaskans looking at the subsistence issue from too many vantage points. States' rights, equal rights, cultural survival, and simple partisan politics. Bridging those divergent views will require strong leadership, something Hudson says was sorely missing last month, but is needed more than ever now.
Where you have our federal, our congressional people, our state people, our native leadership, our urban leadership, all essentially singing out of the same hymnal and trying to find the consensus as to what we're trying to accomplish here will be the solution that will have the long-lasting effect in Alaska that we need.
State Representative Bill Hudson. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Well, it's our position that legally an entity cannot modify their facility and cause an increase in emissions above certain thresholds without filing an amendment to their application, stating the nature of those changes, what those changes will result in the way of increased emissions, and then ultimately determination as to whether or not the increase in any emissions then will have significant effects on public health or the environment.
Three, two, one. Scientists at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks this week are sharing research and ideas on global change and what it means for the polar regions. The conference got underway Tuesday. Some 300 participants will explore how the atmosphere, oceans, biology, and chemistry all impact changes in the Earth. During the conference's opening lecture, Dr. Francis Bretherton told the audience that the biggest challenge of global change faces the scientists themselves. Bretherton says they must come out of their research shells and take a look at the whole planet Earth.
How can we communicate our technical knowledge to a broader public with the right blend of simplification that has to be to communicate effectively, and yet without distorting what we really know or think we know and don't know? This is the biggest challenge of all, how to do both honest science and to be socially responsible.
Bretherton says the greenhouse effect is only one issue. The ozone, acid rain, and deforestation are other symptoms of the increasing population and resources being used. Bretherton says data and measurements are the keys to studying and quantifying the results of the role of clouds and oceans in global change. For CBC News, I'm Ann Thornton in Fairbanks. Three, two, one. The temperature of the globe is increasing, but scientists don't know yet if that's just a cycle. Humans are contributing to the change, but the extent of man's impact still can't be judged. Man has helped increase carbon dioxide emissions, But scientists still don't know how much CO2 is going into the oceans or what could be creating a greenhouse effect over the Earth. Much of what's causing global change needs much more study, but scientists are talking about the impact of those changes on polar regions during a conference in Fairbanks this week. University of Alaska Fairbanks professor Gunter Weller told an audience Tuesday that models show different consequences of global warming. Weller says indications are that things are warming up, and impacts in Arctic regions will be great, affecting things like fisheries.
Marine life, mammals such as walrus, which depend heavily on ice distribution, will could experience fairly substantial changes. The subsistence lifestyles of the native populations in Alaska, which in many villages along the coast still depend heavily on whaling, could be quite strongly affected, because the whales, as they migrate up in spring into the Beaufort Sea, may no longer be depending on leaves and polynyas close to the shore, but can use open water much further from shore, making it more difficult for the native hunters to get to these animals.
Weller says the thickness of sea ice could decrease, making shipping easier on the Arctic Ocean, and permafrost could slowly melt, affecting roads, bridges, and buildings. Several different research papers and studies about global change's impact here are being discussed during the international conference. For CBC News, this is Ann Thornton in Fairbanks. Three, two, one. During the conference's opening lecture, Dr. Francis Bretherton told the audience that the biggest challenge of global change faces the scientists themselves. Bretherton says they must come out of their research shells and take a look at the whole planet Earth.
How can we communicate our technical knowledge to a broader public with the right blend of simplification that has to be to communicate effectively, and yet without distorting what we really know or think we know and don't know? This is the biggest challenge of all, how to do both honest science and to be socially responsible.
Bretherton says the greenhouse effect is only one issue. The ozone, acid rain, and deforestation are other symptoms of the increasing population and resources that are being used. Bretherton told the scientists that their methods of measurement must be precise to get the best knowledge needed to study the problems. The temperature of the globe is increasing, but scientists don't know yet if it's just a cycle. Humans are contributing to the change, but the extent of man's impact still can't be judged. Man has helped increase carbon dioxide emissions, but scientists still don't know how much CO2 is going into the oceans or what could be creating a greenhouse effect over the Earth. Much of what's causing global change needs much more study. But UAF professor Gunter Weller told the audience Tuesday that models show different consequences of global warming. Weller says indications are that things are warming up, and impacts in Arctic regions will be great, affecting things like fisheries.
Marine life, mammals such as walrus, which depend heavily on ice distribution, will experience fairly substantial changes. The subsistence lifestyles of the native populations in Alaska, which in many villages along the coast still depend heavily on whaling, could be quite strongly affected, because the whales, as they migrate up in spring into the Beaufort Sea, may no longer be depending on leaves and polynyas close to the shore, but can use open water much further from shore, making it more difficult for the native hunters to get to these animals.
Weller says the thickness of sea ice could decrease, making shipping easier on the Arctic Ocean, and permafrost could slowly melt, affecting roads, bridges, and buildings. And as ice caps melt, an increase in sea level could wipe out low-lying areas like Bangladesh. Several different research papers and studies about global change's impact here are to be discussed during the international conference. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
But it would be my sense that what the Park Service wants to do is build up a public outcry, vilify the landowner by cutting off a bus travel back in there and making it more difficult for other people to get back in there. They want to make these landowners the villains. I mean, you're never going to have very much tourism in Denali unless you have the kinds of roads that are, you have the ability to deal with the kind of tourism that's necessary, and with all the strangling of the private rights and private lands by the preservation groups, tourism is certainly one way to make it up. It doesn't come anywhere near what they promised, but it can help.
No, I think that the Park Service is taking the responsible position here. They have to ensure that visitors to the park enjoy a pleasant and primarily safe experience. We've had incidents in the recent past of buses rolling off that road, and certainly I don't think anyone wants to see that happen again. And so I believe the Park Service is on the right track here. It's high time we dealt with this issue in any event, and this is the opportunity to have Congress step back in, address the problem, and we hope solve it.
Three, two, one. Nearly 167,000 gallons of fuel spilled north of Nenana near Goldstream Creek. Less than half that amount, some 80,000 gallons, has been recovered so far. Estimates are that between 25% to 40% of the fuel evaporated. Department of Environmental Conservation on-scene coordinator Pete McGee says some fuel also soaked into the soil, so it's hard to say how much is still there to be picked up.
There's certainly some in the vegetation around the edges of the ponds, and then there was a fair amount that soaked into the soil farther to the south end of the tracks, back where the rail cars themselves actually spilled. And Friday, the railroad is due to turn in their long-term, what they're calling a restoration plan that should address the final cleanups for those areas.
McGee says depending on what methods the railroad chooses, the long-term cleanup could go on throughout the summer and maybe into next spring. McGee says there are still about 25 people working at the cleanup site. That includes railroad employees as well as some people hired by the contractors, Verka and Martek. There was some concern last week that as railroad workers are moved in and the contractors doing the bulk of the work eased out, the process would slow down. But McGee says right now the numbers are okay.
They haven't cut back in the total numbers of staff other than the people that were actually removing the log jams from Goldstream Creek. Those MarTech people have finished. We and a number of other agency and interested public people went on a float trip down Goldstream Creek, and there wasn't any evidence of any oil, you know, coming out of the bank or going down Goldstream Creek any farther. So we told them that they could reduce the number of people they had working on the creek, but they had to keep enough people there to maintain the booms and keep the sticks and stuff that get caught in them cleaned out.
McGee says they need to keep the people they've got out there until a more definitive long-term plan is developed, so they can then structure the size of the crew to fit the plan. Since the railroad plans to bring in its own people to do the bulk of the remaining work, railroad spokesperson Vivian Hamilton says that will create job openings elsewhere.
The Alaska Railroad is planning to hire as many as 40 or 50 temporary employees this summer to fill in some of our maintenance jobs. And those maintenance jobs are open now because we've pulled our most senior maintenance employees out of their regular jobs and have trained them in hazardous materials so that we can put them at our spill site near Dunbar.
Hamilton says most of the temporary jobs will be for track laborers to do summer maintenance work along the line. Residents of Nenana and Minto had expressed interest in cleanup jobs, but that requires specialized training. Hamilton says some training was offered in Nenana and Minto, and several people took advantage of it there. The railroad plans to finish cleaning up the spill at Dunbar with its own employees, though. Hamilton says the latest estimates are that the Memorial Day accident will cost the railroad more than $2 million, covering the cost of the cleanup efforts and the damaged tank cars. Hamilton says all those tank cars have just been picked up, and they hope to have them in Anchorage by this weekend to begin a detailed inspection of the cars and their parts, which she says will take some time. The railroad is hoping to learn if the derailment was due to track conditions or something else like mechanical reasons. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. The Hospital Foundation's Board of Trustees has been lobbied by several members of the community since voting to close the Denali Center. Now, with pledges to try to improve the state's Medicaid reimbursement rate and get the money to build a new center, coming from several concerned citizens. Board of Trustees member Red Porter says the board agreed to allow for more time for something to change.
No one ever has wanted to close Denali. Everybody has always been searching for some kind of a solution to get paid for our costs and to create a new Denali Center. And with what we've learned and with what we've seen in the last few weeks, we think there's a good opportunity of maybe accomplishing those things, so we've elected to try to keep it open for another year.
The Hospital Board of Trustees wants to allow some time for at least two things to happen: get an adequate Medicaid reimbursement rate for Denali Center, and get the money needed to build a long-term care facility. What the state pays now for Medicaid patients doesn't cover enough of the expenses to help pay for a new building. The Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Myra Munson, who has criticized the decision to close, says there are things that can be done to improve the Medicaid reimbursement rate. The board wants to allow some time to see if that can be done. Denali Center Administrator Mark Bertelrude took the news back to his staff and residents Wednesday morning. Bertelrude says even though they've been given an extended life in the building, a lot of work still must be done.
It was absolutely a joy to stand in front of everybody today and say that we've got another chance to keep working forward. As you look through the resolution, all of the challenges that lay in that resolution are very much challenges to the staff, and as much as we can take a sigh of relief and see that we've got some breathing room, we all need to dig in very deeply and lead the charge community-wise, that my staff, myself personally, really need to take a leadership role and make sure that people know about Denali Center and what we're all about. The concern is still out there. You know, if everybody kind of thinks the crisis is over and sits back, we're in trouble. But the opportunity is there. Everybody from the staff to the local and state legislators have expressed some commitment. So if we all work together and pull forward on a unified effort, I think we're going to see some amazing results.
The resolution passed by the foundation board outlines a plan to get the money for a new building, but the board still feels the money must come from the state in the form of a grant. Getting that money will require a huge lobbying effort from the community as a regional priority. A March deadline has been set to see how much has been accomplished by then and what still needs to be done for Denali Center to survive. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Direction of the President of the United States of America, Airman John H. Raven is awarded the Purple Heart posthumously for wounds incurred as a direct result of an act of an enemy on 13 May 1990. Airman Raven's sacrifice in the performance of his assigned duties is reflective of the men and women who have given their lives on behalf of freedom-loving people throughout the world. On May 13th, Airman John Raven was killed while on temporary duty to Clark Air Base in the Philippines. Airman Raven was the son of Dennis and Lucille Raven, our neighbors from Delta Junction. Airman Raven was struck down by communist guerrillas as an expression of hate for Americans in general and those in the Philippines specifically. Actions such as the one which took the life of Airman Raven serve to remind each of us and the nation as a whole that service to one's country is not without risk. It also demonstrates that our democratic way of life is still in need of protection. On behalf of a grateful nation, I want to express my thanks to the family of Airman John Raven. While words never make up for your personal loss, I want you to know that we at Eielson are proud of John. We're also proud to know that young men and women like him are willing to sacrifice all to keep our nation free. To Mr. and Mrs. Raven, I also want to say thank you.
Great loss to us and all. We don't feel it's any worse our loss than if it was someone else's son. And we have no bitterness in our hearts toward our government or the military or President Bush or anyone. And
I've led my family through this in a way that not to have their hearts filled with bitterness. It's good to know that he weren't just forgotten totally.
You can't imagine the enormity of what he's planned.
Dick Audette manages the Fred Meyer store on the northeast side of Fairbanks. Audette says the new store on the other side of town won't be just a department store. It'll be nearly 200,000 square feet.
You can put almost three of the current Fred Meyer store inside of it, of the new plant. A food store will be included along with a lot of satellite food products, such as your in-store delis and bakeries and what the general population considers a grocery store.
The $20 to $30 million store won't be ready for at least a year. Audette says plans aren't finalized quite yet, but a store that size will likely need 400 employees and 600 at peak times of the year. Audette says the major investment isn't as much a sign of an economic turnaround as it is a commitment to Fairbanks.
We're very positive about the city. Yes, there was a downward turn in the economy, but as you recall, when we opened our current store in June of 1979, the pipeline was winding down. At a point in time when other businesses were packing up and leaving town, we chose to come in. And at that time, people wondered why a store of our size and stuff was coming into Fairbanks. And over the years, we've simply watched the community. We've gone along with the bad times and done what we could to help in that regard with remodels and boosting more money into the community. And now we feel that it's time to make a stronger commitment to Fairbanks.
The new store will be across from University Center at a fairly busy intersection now. Audette says they're working on a plan for traffic controls at the corner to allow for access from two sides of the property. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
This proposal comes up for a second vote in 1994, and if the people decide that they want to change it, they can do so, and the rural preference will no longer be law. We are optimistic that we will have the votes that we need to pass both the resolution for a constitutional amendment and the proposed statutory language.
Three, two, one. More people than any of the organizers expected showed up to hear the candidates, and they heard their share of mini campaign speeches. During opening and closing remarks, all the candidates got the chance to tell the audience a little bit about themselves and what they hope to accomplish as governor. Most of them stressed their ability to lead. Independent candidate John Lindauer says he's the only one who's been an administrator and a legislator.
We all talk about leadership, but leadership means being committed to actually do something and then having the commitment and the ability and the experience to do it. I believe there's a great difference among the candidates. I'd like to believe that with my experience, I can actually get some things done.
Democrat Ryle White still wants to move the state capitol and build a new city, but he also is selling his ability to lead.
Instead of being a state or having a governor who is going to take action, we're always in a state of reaction. We're never leading, we're just following, we're just tagging along. And Alaska deserves better than that.
Two senators are on the Republican ticket for governor. Rick Halford says the leadership just hasn't been there.
The experience that we've gotten out of the last political leadership has been in the wrong direction. We have to change the direction. To add $300 million to the operating budget this year was an aberration. It was the wrong direction. If the governor was looking to the state of Alaska, he'd be calling a special session on the budget.
And Arla Sturgalewski offered her plan to lead.
As your governor, I'll certainly work with you and with various interests to seek solutions to issues. We don't need polarization. The issues are complex, It means bringing us together, finding solutions, and being able to move ahead.
The other current office holder, Lieutenant Governor Steve McAlpine, was telling the crowd on his experience.
It has taken governors 2.5 to 3 years to really figure out the process. And by then, the public is already disenchanted with the job that is being done and is actively pursuing a new person for that position. I don't think we have the time for on-the-job training.
The short speeches offered the opportunity to learn a little something about the candidates, but it wasn't easy to compare them. The second round of the forum asked each candidate a different question, and each of them got the chance to give their view on a familiar issue. Tony Knowles was asked about the idea of building an education endowment with permanent fund earnings.
I do not feel that that would meet the fairness test, as it would tax all Alaskans, in a sense, equally, regardless of the ability to pay. I think when it comes to providing revenues for essential services and developing a fairness test, that after we have first reduced the level of government spending, after we have looked at user fees and local responsibilities, then I would look to funding the essential services such as education through an income tax.
Other candidates also got to address familiar topics. Sturgalewski supports the proposed natural gas pipeline. McAlpine wants to recriminalize marijuana. And Republican Jim Campbell wants a take-charge governor who'll challenge the feds on occasion. The only opportunity to compare stands on issues came when moderator Rick Sikora asked 25 yes-no questions, which candidates held up one-word signs to answer.
The first question. Do you support the opening of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to petroleum and mineral exploration? Unanimous.
Several questions like that one got all yes answers. Some were all no's, and there was some disagreement on a few. Candidates didn't have to hold up a card if they felt it didn't have a yes-no answer, but they didn't get the chance to explain their views unless they got a question from the audience at the end asking them to. And you had to look quickly to catch the answers. Despite the number of issues that were covered, candidate Jim Campbell knows that it didn't tell it all.
We can all set up here and we can flash cards, yes or no, but that's one thing. It's another thing to make it happen. And as we go into this race, in my race on the Republican side, my motto is going to be, if you want more of the same, vote for a senator. If you want to change, vote for Jim Campbell. Thank you.
They may not have all the campaign pledges down yet, but the audience members who are quick studies at least know some stands on some issues. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
But the experience that we've gotten out of the last political leadership has been in the wrong direction. We have to change the direction. To add $300 million to the operating budget this year was an aberration. It was the wrong direction. If the governor was looking to the state of Alaska, he'd be calling a special session on the budget to look back at what we've done and what we're setting the next legislature up for.
Also, the other thing, or two other things I'm pushing for. One is legalized gambling in the state. Fairbanks, Juneau, and Anchorage would be the main centers. In fact, I think they would be limited to those three cities. You'd have to give Juneau something, as everyone says, when you take the capital away. I'm sorry about that, but that's the way it's going to have to go.
And I believe we can market our natural gas and our coal and our fish and our petroleum products if we do it understanding their cultures and their mores. So if you're asking me if we're going to have more money in the budget for brochures, the answer is no. If you're asking me if we're going to have a major effort to export to the Pacific Rim, the answer is yes.
I do not feel that that would meet the fairness test, as it would tax all Alaskans, in a sense, equally, regardless of the ability to pay. I think when it comes to providing revenues for essential services and developing a fairness test, that after we have first reduced the level of government spending, after we have looked at user fees and local responsibilities, then I would look to funding the essential services such as education through an income tax. I think that that would be the fairest way rather than through a reduction of the permanent fund income earnings.
The first question. Do you support the opening of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to petroleum and mineral exploration? Well, Gary, you're supposed to ring the bell to tell them when to do it. Unanimous.
Ted, again, if we would.
We've always been a state of reaction. Instead of being a state or having a governor who is going to take action, we're always in a state of reaction. We're never leading, we're just following, we're just tagging along. And Alaska deserves better than that.
As your governor, I'll certainly work with you and with various interests to seek solutions to issues. We don't need polarization. The issues are complex. It means bringing us together, finding solutions, and being able to move ahead.
It has taken governors 2.5 to 3 years to really figure out the process. And by then, the public is already disenchanted with the job that is being done and is actively pursuing a new person for that position. I don't think we have the time for on-the-job training. I think that Alaska has to hit the ground running in December of 1990, and I think we have a richness of opportunity and certainly a brilliant future for our state. Thank you.
We all talk about leadership, but leadership means being committed to actually do something and then having the commitment and the ability and the experience to do it. I believe there's a great difference among the candidates. Some of them will go down to Juneau if they were elected, and they would continue the status quo, the same old people doing the same old thing with pretty much the same old results. Others would go down there meaning well, meaning to change it, but in fact, because they've never served in the legislature and don't know how to work with them, or they've never really worked with public employees, they'd have the recent experience of one of our governors and get nothing done no matter how much they want to. I'd like to believe that with my experience, I can actually get some things done. And what I'm committed to do, you'll find right on your table.
We can all set up here and we can flash cards, yes or no, but that's one thing. It's another thing to make it happen. And as we go into this race, in my race on the Republican side, my motto is going to be, if you want more of the same, vote for a senator. If you want to change, vote for Jim Campbell. Thank you.
By direction of the President of the United States of America, Airman John H. Raven is awarded the Purple Heart posthumously for wounds incurred as a direct result of an act of an enemy on 13 May 1990. Airman Raven's sacrifice in the performance of his assigned duties is reflective of the men and women who have given their lives on behalf of freedom-loving people throughout the world.
On May 13th, Airman John Raven was killed while on temporary duty to Clark Air Base in the Philippines. Airman Raven was the son of Dennis and Lucille Raven, our neighbors from Delta Junction. Airman Raven was struck down by communist guerrillas as an expression of hate for Americans in general and those in the Philippines specifically. Actions such as the one which took the life of Airman Raven serve to remind each of us and the nation as a whole that service to one's country is not without risk. It also demonstrates that our democratic way of life is still in need of protection. On behalf of a grateful nation, I want to express my thanks to the family of Airman John Raven. While words never make up for your personal loss, I want you to know that we at Eielson are proud of John. We're also proud to know that young men and women like him are willing to sacrifice all to keep our nation free. To Mr. and Mrs. Raven, I also want to say thank you. Your sacrifices throughout John's life, the love of country you instilled in him, and your willingness to share him with our nation is an example for all Americans to follow. While your loss is far greater than ours, we too feel the pain of a fellow airman who gave his life for his country. Thank you, and may God bless you and comfort you.
Well, it's a great loss to us and all, but we don't feel it's any worse our loss than if it was someone else's son, and we have no bitterness in our hearts toward our government or the military or President Bush or anyone. And I've led my family through this in a way that not to have their hearts filled with bitterness. It's good to know that he weren't just forgotten totally.
Three, two, one. Three city council members think the whole matter should have been decided by an arbitrator. Bob Sundberg is one of the three. He says settling the grievance this way only confirms what was brought up during a review of labor negotiations done for the city by a man named Bill Pack.
Mr. Pack, in a written report just about a month and a half ago, said without a doubt, the city council is not running this city, the unions are running this city. The vote tonight to expend $7,200 of taxpayers' money under a grievance that was filed by the police union over the use of volunteers for the dog races, something that we should all be encouraging, proves beyond a reasonable doubt to me that Mr. Pack is right.
Sundberg said the best way for the grievance to go away would have been for the police department to drop it. He called the settlement a slap in the face to the council. Under the agreement, the council will transfer $7,200 into the police department's overtime budget. That's the amount the police say would have been due the department if police had been used for traffic control during the downtown sled dog race. Under the settlement agreement, neither side admits to any guilt. Clarence Bolden with the Alaska Public Employees Association says the contract was violated when the city manager didn't discuss the planned use of volunteers with the union first, which is required by the contract. He told the council the grievance wouldn't be dropped, and Bolden was glad to see the settlement approved without going to arbitration.
The arbitration process is long and arduous, and it means that we're back and forth dealing in an adversarial manner. And by settling the matter, we can now go to the table, and you know we start negotiations on the Thursday, without this hanging over our heads and without there being that kind of acrimony.
Bolden says if the unions were running things, they would have made things a lot easier for themselves. Acting city manager Bob Wolting recommended the settlement from a financial point of view. If the city lost the arbitration, it would have cost a few thousand dollars more. Councilmember Jim Hayes supported the settlement for some of the same reasons.
It's a case of worms. You know, it's not the best scenario. It's certainly talking to the manager, and they have been working on this for some time. And APA, I feel, was really working hard to get the thing resolved. I support the fact of what the council did to use volunteers. I still do. But I think the long haul, to get all the way down the road, have somebody tell us that we made a wrong move when it could have been avoided and saved us $11,000 is the thing to do. And I think if we had gone to arbitration, there's a good possible chance that we'd have lost. And for what?
The timing of the settlement also helps avoid the same problems for Golden Days events next month. The Chamber of Commerce again asked that fees for police services be waived for Golden Days, raising the same problems again. This time, the police department hopes to provide the volunteers to help with enforcement for that downtown event. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. The borough's Community Research Center conducted its monthly survey of available apartments and found a very low vacancy rate for the month of June. The numbers have been dropping for the last 2 years. In 1989, the number of available apartments was down to an average of about 600 each month. But this month, Research Center analyst Mark Gramstead called the usual people surveyed and found the number of vacancies was down to 92.
I saw it start in late March and in April. The number of vacancies has just been dropping steadily. We're about 2 to 3 months ahead of our normal curve for this time of the year.
Gramstead says the rental market goes in cycles. More units are available in the winter and fewer in the summer months. But he says this year they're about 2 months ahead of the summer trend. The center researchers have a couple of reasons for why that might be happening. More summer arrivals, for one. They say the state may be seeing more people coming in from the Yukon Territory. Those numbers are up 40% for the first quarter of this year compared to 1989. But the military may be having the most impact. It's estimated that both Fort Wainwright and Eielson have more people living off the base and post this year. Eielson housing renovations have limited what's available there, and Fort Wainwright has more people coming in as the Light Infantry Division moves its headquarters here. More military housing is scheduled to open this fall, another 150 units. Mark Ramstead says that might mean the market will loosen up a little, or it might not.
That most probably will free up some places that the military is occupying right now. That might be counterbalanced also, though, by new families coming up from Fort Richardson.
Ramstead thinks there will still be more housing vacancies in the fall again, just not as many as usual.
The bottom could drop out come September and everybody decides to leave. But if they can, if the people that are coming up from the lower 48 can get jobs and the soldiers that are coming in can find places to put their families in, it's probably going to continue as a trend with lower vacancy rates.
Ramstead analyzes the rental data for the research center while Hugh Richards looks at houses listed for sale. Richard says the number of listed homes has also gone down 30% to 40% compared to a year ago. Richard says it's too soon to talk about an upturn in how much homes are selling for, though.
The realtors, I think, would say yes, we are seeing a definite change. We're seeing higher prices and the fact that houses are selling faster. But to look at the actual numbers of asking prices for houses, they've sort of held relatively constant. They bounce around a lot in our numbers, but they've held relatively constant for about a year to a year and a half now.
Richards attributes much of the increased interest in homes and apartments to the military. The Light Infantry Division has nearly doubled the number of soldiers in the Fairbanks area over the last 4 years. The final 300 are expected in the next year and a half. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation has spent a lot of time and energy marketing the airport as a cargo hub. Even though Emory's proposal for the route to Japan had support from Alaska's congressional delegation, pushing for it was still an uphill battle. FIDC Executive Director Ron Ricketts.
We were disappointed, but not surprised. UPS is a very strong company, and we knew going in that it would be difficult for Emory to prevail, and those that are, as you might put it, in the know in Washington confirmed that.
Ricketts says Emory was in a good position because it already has a business base in Japan, but UPS is a known quantity. Ricketts says all is not lost, though, since Emory gets backup authority for the Japanese cargo route.
And so if, for any reason, the service is not performed by UPS, then Emory would be awarded the route. And also, there are other routes that will be anticipated in the future, and consequently, Emory's in good position to pick up one of those routes. So, while we're disappointed, it's not all over with Emory, and certainly we can continue to work with them and want to make sure that we're their gateway of choice when the next opportunity arises.
News that Lufthansa Airlines will move its cargo hub from Anchorage to Fairbanks came on the heels of the Emory bid's defeat. The FIDC estimates that the German air carrier's move will mean as much as $15 billion annually to the local economy, with fuel costs, landing fees, and other activity at the airport. By stopping in Fairbanks instead of Anchorage, the airline takes about 250 miles off its trip and can carry more freight in lieu of extra fuel. Ricketts says Fairbanks is getting attention as a cargo hub now, and marketers here got to learn more about marketing strategy in going through the whole bid process with Emory.
We felt very fortunate to be in the picture as a gateway city, and I think that's a positive for Fairbanks. Demonstrates that we do have airlines out there, and of course Lufthansa's recent decision reinforces that, but we do have airlines that believe we have a viable gateway airport, and that I think this is going to help us in the future. Certainly both the Emory and the Lufthansa decisions to name Fairbanks, though Emory was not successful in getting the route, point toward the fact that we've got some other opportunities with other airlines that may be coming down the pike.
Marketing the Fairbanks Airport is just one aspect of the FIDC's efforts to promote economic activity in Fairbanks. Rickett says they also are looking to diversify more so the local economy isn't so oil-dependent. The mining industry isn't a new one here, but Rickett thinks Fairbanks can be a base for new development. And Rickett says forestry is another industry that offers room to grow here.
In the forest industry, most people aren't aware of this, but we have a huge amount of fiber, which has very great worldwide value and increasing value in view of the loss of forests in other parts of the world. And we have an opportunity, since we do not have a well-developed forest industry at this time, to do a good job in managing that forest and creating some new jobs for our long-term benefit. It's our, really our only renewable natural resource in the interior.
The FIDC has been trying to convince a forest company to build a plant here. Rickett says the company plans to bring someone in to look at the feasibility of that idea. He sees that as a solid step in the planning process. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.